Jason Bhagadwan is a PhD candidate at the Department of Sociology at the University of Toronto. His research interests include race and aging. In this episode, we discuss his dissertation topic, Mall Walking, Community, Pleasure, and Self-Preservation Among Racialized Older Adults. Hi, Jason, and welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you here today, and I'm very excited to know more about you and about the work you've been doing. So to get us started, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself, about your academic background, and more specifically about your interest in race and adulthood as areas of research?
Cool. Yeah. So first off, thanks for having me. I'm a sixth-year PhD candidate. At the University of Toronto in studying in sociology. I had no idea I was going to do grad school. I don't know if this is a common trajectory for most people, but you know, I was actually doing really bad in school in the beginning, my undergrad. I was getting like C's and D's. And then I thought to myself, I need to start trying in school because like I'm just wasting my money here at this point. So you know, my priorities kind of shifted in my third and fourth year, and I ventured into sociology because even when I was doing poorly, the courses I was doing like pretty decent in is in sociology. So I kept continuing it. And then towards the end, I thought, I think I might want to do grad school. And originally, I was really interested in the body and the ways that the different spaces that people occupy will shape the body in different ways. So the most prominent example is a gym, because I had a lot of friends growing up who just started going to the gym regularly, and I noticed a big change in their attitude and the way that they approach the world, and I saw that it brought a lot of positive benefits into their life. And so originally I wanted to do a study on CrossFit because that's sort of where my friends were at, and I was sort of doing that for my dissertation, but I didn't. And one day while I was walking towards the mall just to take a break during an exam, I came across this group of older adults, and they were just walking. They were in t-shirts that said a Mall Walkers Club. And I was really fascinated by that. So I just approached them because I like to think I'm an approachable person. And I approached them and I started to ask them about what they were doing and who they were and how often they met. And they invited me to actually join them. And it just so happened that the community that just primarily composes of like Black and brown women, mostly Black women from the Caribbean. And so that's sort of how I came into it. There was no prior knowledge that they existed beforehand. I just sort of came across it one day during one of my walks. Because I think it's important to take walks for breaks because it's good for a month. It's good to think. It helps you clear your head and reset. And so now my research has just sort of turned into research about walking and how people use private spaces to gather, to exercise, and to stay connected to one another.
Right. You know, I think it's really interesting how I think, you know, if you look at this whole definition of what fitness and exercise is and what it encompasses, I think it changes so much during your entire life course, right? Because like I remember, right, like when I was younger, there was no such thing as like going to the gym and being fit. It was just going downstairs, playing with your friends and stuff like that. And then, you know, I think as we get older, right, we have like these regimented time in between our schedule to take break, like take a Zumba class or play a sport or something like that. So yeah, I know that this is the topic that you've like touched on as a part of your research as well. So I'm just a bit curious to know as to how or at what point we really lose our sense of play as we age and how the concept of play and fitness and all of that evolves over the course of our lives.
You know, I think that's interesting. I think as we grow up and we take on more responsibilities, we start to lose that sense of play because we can only partition our time so much in a day, right? And when you're a kid, you're encouraged to play. You're encouraged to go out and socialize. And I don't know about you, growing up, I didn't even do any of my homework. I just went out and played after school. And like, that's all I cared about was like doing recess. So as you could tell, that followed my trajectory of not doing so well in school. I think the problem is when we turn into adults, we start to internalize this sense of, I have these responsibilities. I have to work, I have to get a job, I have to finish school. For people who want to enter into families and start families, that becomes a responsibility. And so when you have all of these things taking up your time, you have less time to play. And then play becomes less important in your life as a cultural value. I think that's unfortunate. I think it's really due to the forces of capitalism and neoliberalism telling us that we have to, we're responsible for our own well-being. And that responsibility comes with sacrifices. And these sacrifices sometimes have to do with things that bring us joy and leisure and pleasure. And we lose a lot of that. I think it's really interesting when you talked about how fitness changes over the life course before asking this question, because that's something I never actually thought about. I think it really does the when we're growing up, we're more creative about the way we play because we don't know about sports. We may not have access to a bunch of equipment to play sports, but as we grow older and some of us make more money, we can start to access different classes like yoga, Zumba, CrossFit for some people, weightlifting. Or organized sports where people can exercise. So that was a really good point that you brought up.
Yeah, definitely. Again, right, like when we think about exercise and play, as we grow up, I think like these terms just become defined more like rigidly, right? But I think again, they are like they don't necessarily have to be, like these tight categories. And I think that there actually can be a lot of overlap in like both of like these areas, right? So can you tell us a little bit about that, what your findings look like on that front?
Well, actually, is it okay if I ask you a question?
Sure, yeah, go for
Like,
it.
what does play look like to you, like now at your stage in your life?
Wow, I've never really thought about it. I think like for me at least, like I like playing sports, right? So I think I would sort of classify playing basketball as, something that I'm playing or, and again, I think a more primitive sort of play, like I wouldn't want to use that word, but if I were to go there, I'd say maybe playing hide and seek or hopscotch is sort of primitive. I mean, like, in fact, I could think of an example of this. So I've got cousins of mine, right? And like every time I like go and like visit them, we play in that sense. And I mean, it is really fun, but I think it's also a little sad that, I think as we grow up and stuff, right? Like if I would meet my friends and stuff, like we just meet at like malls and restaurants and maybe at the beach. Like we don't really think of playing hide and seek or like games like that. I mean, in somewhere we just grew up, right? And we just accepted it as a part of life. And I mean, again, like your research looks at that, which is sort of what I find really interesting.
And I sort of like the reason, thank you for answering that. And like the point of asking that question is to ask ourselves, at what point do we think it's too childish to play hide and seek and too childish to play hopscotch, right? Because again, as you're saying, fitness changes over the life course. We feel like some of these activities are tied to certain ages, which is the life course perspective. And so when we get older and we think, like, oh, I think I'm too old to play hide and seek. But however, if you have kids, maybe you won't feel that way because you'll play hopscotch and stuff with your kids because we think that these are age appropriate games. But in reality, that's like socially constructed, right? Like we could, like you and I, if we ever met up in person, we could play hide and seek. We'll just feel childish about it. And sort of that's the point of when I say I think capitalism kind of destroys that is because it kind of tells us sort of what exercises we should be doing at our point in life, right? Especially when you think of gender. And you think of men's fitness, like men are supposed to be strong, they're supposed to be big, they're supposed to lift weights, they're supposed to be fast, they're supposed to be athletic, right? Whereas for the kind of exercises that women get prescribed are to tone their bodies, right? To tone their lower body more than the top of their body, because we as a society we value like big butts, for example, right? Like I'm not even gonna like skirt around that, like. You look at an exercise magazine for women and it says a different exercise than exercise magazine for men. And so that's why I think fitness is such an interesting thing to study race and gender. I'm not an expert at studying the relationship between exercise and race because, again, there's not a lot of literature on that. And I just look at joy, right, and see how joy is attached to race just because. When we think about race and ethnicity, we're always constantly thinking about inequality, histories of colonialism and slavery and imperialism. And we don't really think about how of Black joy, for example. And this is the topic that a colleague of mine, Jade Nixon at University of Toronto, always kind of stressed to me. And her research is about Black joy, because we need to rewrite some of these narratives on race. And so that's when I talk about race in my work, I'm talking about looking at community participation, looking at how people come together to celebrate not their fitness, but to celebrate that they're still alive and they're congregating together. Whereas a lot of theories of aging just look sort of like at individual people. And we tend to individualize aging in such a way that we blame people for not being healthy enough in old age, when in reality, you know, it takes a village. And the thing about the mall walkers is that they take care of each other. And that's sort of what I look at in my research.
Definitely, right. And I think something you said, which I'd really like to pick up on more, is this idea of how there are certain sports and activities, right, like which have been, you know, for so long, I think not just tied to age or gender, but I think very closely tied to, you know, like certain communities as well, right? You know, like, why is it that, you know, and again, like, I think a lot of stereotypes actually maybe do have some basis in them, right? Like, why is, you know, like, always said that, you know, like, African Americans are like good runners and good basketball players, all right? You know, like, is it that culturally sort of like constructed thing that was always there in their community that maybe selected for like that gene or something? Or is it that, you know, it's just like a purely like a sociological thing? Yeah, like, I'm just curious to know like your thoughts on that.
Right. Well, I approach my research, it's hard to even say I approach it sociologically, because there's anthropology, because ethnography comes from, I think, anthropology, from what I understand, and sociology sort of just takes the methodology. I don't really take a biological determinant perspective on exercise. It's just because I think everything is socially constructed. And so people, like, there's stereotypes that people are good at certain sports, but that also just comes with years of regimented training and growing up with a certain sport. I don't think there's anything biological about why somebody is more athletic than the other. I mean, that's just my sociological background. I'm not like an evolutionary developmental anthropologist that like studies maybe how genes have been, how genes were selected. I just look more of, like, especially for my mall walkers, right? Like, what do? They walk, because we know that there are limits to what the body can do when you're over 70 or 80 years old. They do aerobics because it's less impact and it's cardio based and it's a full body workout. And there's also groups that do Tai Chi Qigong, which is, I think, a Chinese traditional meditation, dynamic meditation, right? Because these are the types of exercises that the body can handle at a certain point, in addition to being able to walk in a mall.
For sure, yeah. And in fact, I think something that you'd also mentioned early on, that you'd mentioned that this group nearly exclusively or mostly has Black women or African American, you know, women, right? So I think in that sense, I just like to know that, like, is there any reason why it's racially like tied in particular, or is it just that it became that way like over time?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think neighborhood dynamics. So basically, that neighborhood growing up was majority Caribbean and South Asian. There's a big Tamil population in Toronto. It has one of the highest Tamil diasporas and also South Asian diasporas. And so I think as the neighborhood has changed, there were, you know, a lot of, as gentrification happens, more of my families move in. And so real estate goes up, a lot of people tend to move out or get pushed out, really. Like, that's like the violence of capitalism and gentrification. And so I think this community who's been here for a really long time, a lot of these people immigrated in the 60s and 70s, were able to secure some form of housing, or were able to access housing before things got more expensive here. And so I think these are people who go to church together, and there's a big community around that. And so they all become friends, and really, yeah, sorry, I think that answers that question.
That's really interesting that you mentioned that there are Tamilians, because I live in Chennai, like I'm currently in Chennai, which is the capital of Tamil Nadu, which is a state in India. So, you know, like, they've like literally like come from here, right? Like, that, you know, like, roots are right here. And I also think it's interesting in that sense, because today if I go to a mall, right, like over here, I don't see a mall group or like a community in that sense. I mean, I just see young people. So it's very youth driven, very youth oriented. And because you've mentioned these ideas of capitalism and all of that, I think it really appeals to the youth, right? Like I don't really see the mall as a place of exercise and like fitness in that sense. So why is it that a mall is specifically being chosen like for this purpose?
Yeah, that's a great question that has multiple perspectives. I think one perspective is that you're absolutely right. Capitalism is driven by the youth and driven by consumption, and youth are the ones who are often spending their money. I think with this mall, it's not a very popular mall. And I think that's what makes this whole case study so interesting is, a group of mall walkers about 20 years ago came up to mall management and said, "Hey, we want to start a mall walkers club here." And then they had to set certain rules and boundaries because they were down for it because they knew it would increase mall traffic, because not a lot of youth really go to this mall. Like it's a small one, it's single floor, so it's just a lot of walking, and it primarily composes of like clothing stores, discount stores. So it's not and maybe a McDonald's and a bank. Right, it's not exactly the most popular mall for youth, and I think that's one of the features that draw the mall walkers to it, because these are spaces where they can feel safe and away from youth who feel like they're constantly judging them. Right, there's like stereotypes and intergenerational conflict at times where older people think that younger people are judging them, and vice versa. Really, like the whole okay boomer kind of meme that went around. I'm personally not a fan of intergenerational trauma, but that's what happens when people are just kind of cruel and mean to each other. The other thing is, when they were making up the rules to this mall, is that they had to come before the mall officially opened so that they wouldn't interfere with mall with just everyday foot traffic in the mall. So the only things that would be open at 7 a.m. are in the McDonald's at the time, pre-pandemic. Now the malls are closed, so they can't even use the mall, which we could talk about later. So what happens is you have to come in, and if you remember, you have to be wearing running shoes, and you have to be wearing a shirt that says a Mall Walkers Club on it. That way, the security can identify who is allowed to be there and who's not. Which is not to say that I've never really seen them kick anyone out that's not allowed to be there, but it's more of like drawing these boundaries about, who the mall is deciding to let in and who they prefer to let in before all the stores open, because there's not a lot of incentive for a mall to open up that early. Because if none of the stores are early, why should they let people in? But a lot of the times, what happens, and this is maybe where capitalism comes in, we know McDonald's is open. So right after they exercise, a lot of them just flock to the McDonald's or the food court and will sit there for hours and just chat and socialize, which sort of shows how maybe exercising is what brings people there, but in reality, what people keeps people together is the socializing part.
Even I would imagine, right, that in fact I think this is something that's common to people of all ages. Like if you're at a mall, it is generally more fun to go with your friends, right? Like even I would, like to go along with my friends, like browse through stores and stuff with my friends. I feel like you can do it like by yourself, but it's not as much fun. But yeah, I think something that I'd also like to touch upon a little bit is your methods of research. Like have you looked at like quantitative data and like how exactly like does like the whole like the trajectory of your entire dissertation look like in that sense?
So I do participant observation, which is just, in my opinion, just another way of doing ethnography. Well, ethnography composes of participant observation and interviews, really. And so what I do is I attend whenever they meet. So pre-pandemic, I was attending Monday, Wednesdays, Fridays from 7 a.m. to whenever I decide to go home. I would meet up with certain people because eventually you become friends with certain groups and you walk with certain people or do certain activities. And so I got to know people by doing a walk along. Basically, I would walk with people before the main exercises start, because there's a schedule to their mall walking activities between 7 and 9. That was the agreement. So between 7 and 8, people could just walk. At around 8 o'clock, in the middle of one of the atriums, there's a Tai Chi Qigong group that does their exercise from 8 to 8:40. And then in the food court from 8:30 to 9, there are different people doing the aerobics exercises. So it's really up to the person who comes to choose whatever they want. There's a lot of people who just walk and they don't take part in any of the social activities. So my research, I tried to do all three. So I would come in early, which requires waking up early, which, you know, it's hard. Waking up to exercise as a youth, still hard. I don't know why people assume that because I was 27 when I started this, that I'm supposed to be full of energy. I'm supposed to come ready, come excited and enthusiastic, when I'm like, okay, a lot of people in my age group might not be awake yet unless they have a full-time 9-to-5. And like, cause if I'm going to come here for 7 a.m., you're going to ask me to wake up at around 6 o'clock, and that's just like ungodly for me. But that's sort of what I did. I'm not gonna lie to you, there were a lot of times I never came on time. I sort of just came towards the end because people are tired. But I would try to walk, so then I would find this group or a couple or just a single person and ask if I can walk with them, ask them how their day is going, ask them about, you know, anything that they want to talk about, because really that's the point of ethnography. And then there are times where I'll do the Tai Chi Qigong, because I need some more meditation in my life. I think it's really cool, and it also really helps, because I didn't realize how useful meditation is until I started doing it with a bunch of like 80-year-old Taiwanese couple, because they were really and you know, on average like about 15 to 20 people are doing those. And then I'll head off right after that to the food court to join them in the aerobics, and I would mostly exercise with the same people because the food court is big. And the reason why they work out in the food court, because the structural features of the food court allow them to do it safely, because the tables are so heavy that you can use them to hold on whenever you need some balance. But also you can sit whenever you need to. And I think that is sort of what differentiates the Mall Walkers Club and the exercises they do to a more professional setting. Like if you go to a community center and you go to a class, there's probably not the tables or chairs. I don't know, I haven't been, but the ability to just pick and choose whenever you work out, you sit down, stand up, gives a lot of people more agency, is what I noticed. And so I think that's one of the strengths of participant observation in my research, is that I get to not only just look at what people do, the things that people say, but also how they interact with the space that's available to them. So nothing quantitative, I'll be honest.
Right. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And I could really relate to that part about finding it difficult to wake up early. Even I find it really hard. In fact, I don't get this about my own grandma, right? Like, she wakes up at 6 to do gardening. I'm like, you have the whole day to do gardening. Like, why do you need to wake up at 6 for that? And I remember seeing this one, I think it was a tweet on Twitter, where there was basically this screenshot of like a text, and a grandma had like sent her grandson, you know, well, I guess I'll just wish myself happy birthday today. And it was 7 a.m. when she sent that, and the guy had like not like woken up yet. And he's like, wow, okay. But but I think, you know, like you also mentioned, right, like during your ethnography, like people, like they just, you know, like walk together and spoke about stuff that's been on their mind. So I'm just curious, right, like, you know, like what do they like usually talk about? I mean, like the day has just started, so yeah.
They talk about what they watched on TV the other day, the things that they see on the news. They talk about things that happen in the neighborhood, because that neighborhood historically, maybe like a couple decades ago, but even bleeding into now, has never been a safe neighborhood. There's been a lot of shootings. And so whenever there's another shooting, they talk about that. They talk about world events. They'd love to talk about politics. So like, you know, I think that comes with watching a bunch of, sometimes for some people, Fox News and CNN. So, and some of them are American that immigrated to Canada. So then they'll talk about US politics. It's a whole range of things, but whenever I'm there, sometimes they like to talk to me and ask me about my life. It's funny because they really want to get to know me more, especially when we sit at McDonald's for hours, because we can only talk about politics and the news for so long until they turn to me and start asking me about my personal life, because they still think that. And you know, it's funny, we have this joke that I tell them I'm never gonna get married, or they're asking me when I'm gonna get married or have kids, and I'm just like, yeah, I don't know, I play along with it because it's really fun, but Those conversations get really interesting, and it's nice. You know, when they start asking about my personal life, what my plans are, if I plan to get married or have kids, like that's how you know in an ethnography that they're comfortable with you and they want to get to know you rather than they're pushing you away.
Yeah, for sure. I'm glad to hear that, right? I think, and I mean, it's also a nice way to start your day, you know, like you've like woken up and you're starting off with, you know, like casual conversation, unless you're talking about like gun shootings and like serious political stuff. That's not, you know, the most ideal sort of circumstance. But yeah, you know, I think something else that you'd mentioned, right, is that, you know, they also have like these Tai Chi classes, and the way that, you know, I've, you know, like seen it, right, is that I think to sort of take us back to the point on how a lot of these sports and, you know, like fitness regimes are racialized, bracketed, like be associated with like certain communities, right? On the top of my head, I can think of Zumba, which is a primarily Latino thing that originated, right? And then apart from that, you'd also mention CrossFit, which is like a USA-based thing, right? So I think in that sense, have a lot of the people who take part in these things, has it bleeded into like one another, or are they still very, you know, race-specific or community-specific?
That's a really good question because I talked to some of the Black mall walkers and the Caribbean ones, and some of them are less likely to do Tai Chi Qigong. And if it makes sense when you listen to the things that they say, when because like I think one of the complaints that I hear commonly is it's too slow. Because if you look at the aerobics, it's not just aerobics where they're listening to like, I don't know, music you would traditionally think of aerobics. I don't even know what genre that would be. But maybe like pop or something. Like a lot of the music they exercise to, this is why I like to say it's dance, is because it's a lot of soca. So soca, calypso, like genres associated with the Caribbean. And so a lot of these involve fast-paced music or slow reggae, which they'll stretch to. There's a lot of hip movements. So it's actually, so the way I think ethnicity comes out is in music selection and then the way that they exercise, because people take turns to do the exercises, and people have different, I guess, moves that they like to call it, because they don't say they call it exercise, but they also say whenever they want me to lead, which I don't, because that's really hard. They're like, you know, you got to show us your moves, right? Which to me implies some sort of dance, because that's what I think half the time is we're dancing to these songs and we're just happening to exercise, right? I think when you brought up way earlier, and I wrote it down here. The relationship between play and exercise is a good conversation to have, because I think at what point does exercise become play? At what point is exercise pleasurable, right? And I think that's a good question to ask, because it's what, in my opinion, motivates people to continue doing exercises. When your exercise becomes monotonous and predictable and not diverse and varied, people start to sort of lose touch and start to have less fun. So like your sense of play or pleasure goes down. I think that's one of the strengths of, say, CrossFit, where it's always going to be varied. But in the context of a mall walkers club, there's not a lot of variation, in my opinion, because they'll use the same songs, unless it comes to Christmas, which then you get like the Christmas soca tunes and Christmas calypso tunes, which I really, really love. So, yeah, I mean, what do you think? What do you think is, when does exercise and play stop going hand in hand, or do they have to go hand in hand?
Yeah, I think, you know, well, I mean, like the way that I also see it, right, is that I think if you're enjoying exercise, right, like whatever that is, there is some element of play there. We may not necessarily call it play in like a conventional sense, but I think it's still there. But I think for a lot of people who look at fitness as a part of like a weight loss program or something like that, I think it becomes much more of a chore. And I think in that sense, it really takes away the like the pleasure aspect of pain, which I think is pretty sad because it's not really the way things should be, right, in like an ideal world. So yes, I think that's there. And like take us back to the title of your dissertation, right? I think you've also mentioned the word self-preservation. So does this have anything to do with play or with exercise specifically, or?
Yeah, I think the idea with self-preservation is what are we doing to keep ourselves alive? And I think it's more of a philosophical question, right? To tie back to something you just said, you know, there's a certain point where working out becomes a chore, right? And so there's a certain point where you feel like if the exercises you're constantly doing are difficult, then it just becomes work. Like you're working on yourself and you're working on your body. And that's sort of a rhetoric you see a lot in self-care. In like common cultural perceptions of self-care, it's like, oh, we have to learn how to take care of ourselves. And it's like, well, a lot of people have been saying that we have to do that, but it's just because it got co-opted as like this movement. All of a sudden, people are starting to pay attention to it. And now we're selling self-care books and self-help books. Because like a lot of those things have been happening for a really long time. And I just think that that's not the conversation that we should be having about self-care. Like self-care 100% is important, because I think that people should be responsible and take care of themselves, especially for self-preservation. But at the same time, I think we need to radicalize how we think about self-care or care in general. And we need to go back into looking at community care, right? I think to me, that's the antithesis of self-care. And I think self-preservation is, I don't even know why I wrote that. Because to me, it's about taking care of yourself. How do people take care of themselves in order to stay alive? That's the whole point of self-preservation. But I think what's happened when I was writing that was that it's sort of this critique of self-preservation. And I'm critiquing that idea because in reality, if you look at what people are doing here, we're actually taking care of each other. We're calling each other, because mall walking goes beyond just walking around the mall. It goes to saying hi to people as you walk by them in the mall. It goes more into being able to celebrate one another by, they're the ones, they host parties and banquets and picnics where it's to celebrate themselves. And this is community care more than it is self-preservation. So I really like that you picked that up, because I'm starting to think that I put that there as a critique, and that I'm critiquing this idea of self-preservation, but also because there's this wonderful quote by Audre Lorde that I really love. Caring for myself is not an act of self-indulgence. It's self-preservation, and that inherently is political. That's not the quote word for word, but that is a quote that's sort of gotten me through this dissertation and to remind me why I'm doing my dissertation. And I think she wrote that in a burst of light when she's talking about cancer, because she was diagnosed with cancer. And when you're a Black woman diagnosed with cancer and you don't have a lot of support available for you, then caring for yourself is political resistance, and it is an act of political warfare. And so maybe those are the two sort of dominant meanings behind why I put that as one of the aspects of my dissertation.
That's crazy. Yeah, I didn't. I think I hadn't imagined that it has so much meaning packed in. And I think to the point of critiquing self-preservation, and I think it's, I just sort of like extend that idea a little bit to critiquing capitalism as a whole, right? And this whole, and this whole idea of like self-care, as you pointed out, right? Because at some point, right, like self-care just got equated to candles and luxurious baths and, reading all these books and all that, right? And I
Exactly.
mean, what if I don't like want to do that stuff? Capitalism tells me that, but this is how you achieve happiness. And I'm like, okay. Right. So yeah, I think, to like look at that more like generally, right? I think like what capitalism does is that it just repackages a lot of these trends and just makes it look all glamorous and fancy. And I think that's also the thing with sports as well, right? Like if you look at like CrossFit and, and a lot of the exercises that they do. If you on the other hand, look at like farmers or something, right? Like their work, we don't see it as glamorous, but they do very taxing work every day, and they are among, I would imagine, like the healthiest people on the planet, right? Because they are so associated, with like their immediate environment, and like nature around them and stuff like that, right? So yeah, I just think I'd like to more specific look at, it's like a general theme that we've like spoken about so far, but I'm just a bit more curious to know about how a lot of the exercises we do have capitalism sort of embedded into it. I know it's a very like long and general question, but I'd just like to hear your thoughts.
What does capitalism have to do with exercise?
Yeah.
Ooh, that's a good question. I think I'd like to answer that by talking about CrossFit as a sport, because originally that's what I wanted to do. So I did CrossFit for a couple of years. And I think CrossFit is such a radically individualized sport, but dressed as community. Not to say that I don't like CrossFit, right? Like I actually enjoyed my time doing it. I made amazing friends, and I feel like my body can, I didn't realize the things that my body could do when I was doing CrossFit. But when you look at CrossFit as a sport, you see that it's so ableist, right? It really relies on people being big and strong. There's no weight classes, there's only gender. And there's the only classes they have is like regular RX scaled or like masters. Masters for them are people over 35. But they're already acknowledging that people get old in CrossFit, right? And I use air quotes there when you're 35, because some scientific evidence showing that testosterone decreases in males at a certain age in the 30s, right? And so they're trying to use science constantly to say, hey, our program is really good, and that we try to level out the competition, in a fair way. But I still think that it glamorizes fitness to an extent that it becomes a lifestyle, right? You're not just doing CrossFit as a sport, but you're, and this is what happened to me. You start eating properly, you start training differently, you start having to take care of your body. Because if you want to keep doing CrossFit, you have to maintain your body in a certain way, or you're going to fall behind really quick. And the way you fall behind is because you're constantly working out in small classes with your friends, and they're recording their scores on the board after every workout. And so like, oh man, like you're inherently comparing yourself. And so this is what I mean, like this is how a really rich sport can go that radical individualizing part of self-preservation, because it really is about if it's your fault if you fall behind, because you have to keep up with everything. But at the same time, like if you are able to afford it and you have the time and money to invest into CrossFit, you will probably live a very long and healthy life, right? Your cardiovascular system is probably going to be very strong because you're constantly doing conditioning. They care about making sure these movements work for you in real life. So that's why there's a lot of squats and pull-ups. Like there's a lot of push, pull, like everything is regimented by like with scientific evidence. And again, using that with air quotes, because it's a lot of kinesiology studies. I know it doesn't directly answer the question between the link to capitalism, but the way I think about it is that the more money you invest in it, the more you're going to get out of it. And really, it goes beyond just doing it as a sport, but it becomes a lifestyle. So you're clo you start, athleisure, you start buying different kinds of clothes, different proteins, different types of supplements to aid in your work. So then it becomes this all-encompassing sport that becomes its own identity. And I think it's important to recognize that relationship between self-worth and achievement, because again, that's where like that neoliberal ideology comes from, is that we should only feel good about ourselves when we're achieving things. And I think mall walking is an antithesis to that, right? It's in direct competition of like, this is why I originally wanted to compare CrossFit and mall walking among older people, because when you're mall walking or you're doing aerobics, you're not trying to be the fittest person in the room. In CrossFit, the point is to be the fittest person in the room, right? But like that's among people that are like maybe in their 20s or 30s. But when you're in your 70s and 80s, what does it matter, right? Like to what end? And this is like the philosophical questions that really come out of this dissertation is, why do we want to be so fit? What is the point in being so fit, right? Like people are going to experience cognitive and physical decline no matter what, right? But there's a difference between accepting that that's going to happen and trying to prevent it as much as you can via CrossFit or any other types of physical activities, where people want to hold on to as much power as they can. Maybe that's that's like an underlying message of this podcast interview. Like, I don't know.
I never thought that we'd go so deeply into this. Like even my other episodes, I mean, it's just, I was talking about, okay, like this is, like what you did, like why you find it interesting, all of that. But yeah, I never really noticed like, like the whole deep bent into it. But yeah, I think, the other question, right, like I wanted to ask is, apart from the obvious McDonald's you have at the end of the day, is there any element of capitalism, that you see in like the mall workers club, at least?
I think the irony of the mall walkers club is they're exercising in a mall, right? So they're using consumer spaces, but in non-consumer ways. They're literally going to the mall when nothing is really open. So like they're using this space and it's not generating profit, right? Because that's the tenet of capitalism, is that the things that you do have to generate profit. And maybe they do when they go to McDonald's after, because that's really the only thing that's open when they start. Or maybe they go grocery shopping right after. But what I love so much about it is that it seems like it's a critique of capitalism. Mall walking might be a critique of capitalism, because even though they're using the space, that's not really meant for them. It's meant for more youth-driven consumption. They're owning it, right? They're allowed to be subjective. They're allowed to be autonomous. And I think that's sort of one of the takeaways of this dissertation, is that we can use consumer spaces as public spaces. It doesn't always have to generate profit.
Yeah, that's really cool. Like, I never really thought of it that way, you know, I think. And I mean, it's also quite ironic, as you mentioned, right? Because I think, like, at least like when I, you know, go to a mall, you see all these flashy billboards, you see all these lights and everything, you know, from even like the changing rooms in the malls, right? Like, I think, you know, like they have all like the special lighting that, you know, just makes the clothes look so good on you. I mean, you go back home, you're like this looks good, but not the way that it looked back there, you know? So I think like every small element is, you know, like tailored towards making you buy more and want more and look better and feel better. But so yeah, I think to use it in such a way and to get like permission also, I think is pretty radical in that sense. Yeah, so I think I'll just wrap up with the final question, which is that, as you already know, I think sociology is a field of study which is very tied to human beings, right? So we can't, you know, we aren't like molecules in a lab, as you may have heard. You know, we are constantly a product of our times, and you know, we are like interact along with like people all the time, right? So so yeah, I think in that sense we can't really separate ourselves from the research that we do. So I'd just like to know if you have ever felt that your experiences or background or identity has influenced the course of your research, either in terms of your access to resources or literature review or, you know, interviews or anything along those lines.
Yeah, that could be a whole other episode on reflexivity and positionality. I don't know if you've ever come across those terms, but reflexivity is this idea that knowledge production, like, how is our relationship? So positionality is, how is our relationship and our social position tied to our relationship in the field? And I like to think that, you know, like, I don't think a lot of research can be truly objective. And I think by doing qualitative studies or even ethnography, just it's inherently subjective. But like, the point is that I'm embracing these subjectivities. I'm embracing that the world is going to be complex, and that anything I write about it is going to be biased. I think that a big part of the reason I'm doing this research is because of a family member of mine who was dying, and they had Parkinson's and Alzheimer's, and we were constantly trying to figure out what to do. How do we get this person to be more healthy? But they already got diagnosed, right? Like, if you have Parkinson's, all you can really do is slow down the symptoms of it and the onset of it. And so I remember being around my family, they were debating, it's like, oh, we should get her some exercise equipment, we should do this. And it's just like, and then in my head, I'm like, or can we just consider the fact that this person lives alone? You know, they don't have they don't have access to friendship networks. And so I like to think that my experience with how we dealt with that situation influences why I'm doing the research that I'm doing. And I care so much about how people, because at the end of the day, I think I already said this, people come to exercise, but in reality, what they're doing is they're exercising together. They're socializing together. And it's not an accident that we spend more time. If you think about it, if you're actually in the field, you'll see that we spend more time gossiping and talking at McDonald's than we actually do exercising, because you can only exercise for so long. So, you know, isolation and loneliness became a part of my dissertation, is probably one of the underlying issues in my dissertation.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think. And I think, you know, I think that whole trend of how when we exercise or when we play or do any sort of social activity at all, you know, I think like for that matter, it just makes it so much more fun, right? I think that's why, you know, even like running marathons or running, you know, like out in the open, I think is always a much better option than, you know, running on a treadmill in the gym. I like personally don't know anyone who enjoys treadmill running. I don't. I'm a much bigger fan of outdoor running. And I think it's also because if you're exercising along with other people, I think the whole, I mean, we are social beings, so of course, you know, that factor is there. And yeah, you know, I think something else that it also like reminded me of is that when we look at data purely quantitatively in terms of the numbers, I think it also in some ways detaches us from the issue at hand, right? Like we're just dealing with numbers, so it just makes it much more easier and much more clinical to talk about. But when we actually have stories behind it, do we realize that, oh, like, you know, these things actually affect us on a mass scale? So I think in that sense, you know, in like a lot of like cases, quantitative and qualitative data actually goes really well hand in hand. So yeah, that's about it from my end. So thank you, Jason, for taking out the time today. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, likewise. I had a lot of fun, and thank you for answering my questions too.
Thank you for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed this episode, then please do subscribe or follow. You can also follow us on Twitter or Instagram at the handle DTRRH Podcast for further updates.